You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
We have a really fascinating topic today, although one that's a little bit, well, very sad. I mean, in its origins, but certainly a phenomenon that was important in Louisiana. You know, we hear about yellow fever a good bit, and I guess mostly out of New Orleans. Governor Claiborne, the first American governor, his wife died because of yellow fever.
Right.
And I believe one of his children, and so, and one of his aides, and so. Welcome to New Orleans.
Right.
But Shreveport has a really fascinating story to tell. And this year they're commemorating the 150th anniversary since it was first spotted. Anyway, with me today is a person who knows a whole lot about it. And actually, she's a large part of the commemoration effort. It's Dr. Cheryl White. She's a professor of history at LSU Shreveport. I love her specialty. She teaches medieval and early modern Europe, as well as British history. And you've also been active in local history in Shreveport and published numerous books. She's also a popular speaker and lecturer. And she has haunted haunts or historic haunts of Shreveport tours that she gives as a fundraiser. So, wow, what interesting stuff. Well, hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
So people became aware of this, it would have been in August of 1873, and I understand there was like a bank, and not far from that, there were three bodies that were found,
right,
which I guess were diagnosed as yellow fever. So first of all, why were the bodies out in the road? That were they on the road? They'd been in an infirmary, and they just carried them off, or what would happen?
So they, what happened is that, you know, yellow fever was no stranger to Shreveport. Yellow fever had been in Shreveport going back to the 1830s when the city was first founded, when the river was cleared, because people need to understand that it's the river traffic and the transient nature of the population, because we were a port that brings people in. Same thing is true in New Orleans. So in 1873, there's a ship that anchors that docks in New Orleans, called the Valparaiso, and on board that ship was a first mate who had yellow fever, and he stepped off that boat into New Orleans, and he introduced yellow fever there in midsummer of 1873. Well, by August, the first cases are showing up in Shreveport, because goods are coming through New Orleans. They're being put on the Atchafalaya and then on the Red River and coming to Shreveport. So those first three men who by late mid to late August, 1873, who show up in the Shreveport infirmary, were so far gone, and in the sense that their symptoms were such that the infirmary seems to have just intuitively knew they couldn't do anything to help them. So they turned them away. And that's why these men were found dead the following day. And it was yellow fever.
Was there yellow fever connected to the guy who got off the ship in New Orleans?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it is carried by mosquitoes. And so we can track through the records of the ships and the vessels, we can track, like, we know that Valparaiso docked in New Orleans and the first cases appeared when Jose Arrua, who was the first mate on that vessel, stepped off the ship. He fell ill with it and died. And now we have an outbreak of yellow fever in New Orleans. And then it makes its way up the river. There's a few cases in Alexandria. There's a few cases in Natchitoches. And then when it arrived in Shreveport, the conditions were just right for the mosquito population to really take hold. We had the worst, rainiest summer on record ever in 1873. And there was standing water everywhere.
Oh. This reminds me of what little I know about the bubonic plague, but I think, remember that the first case was in the Messina.
Sicily.
Or Sicily, yeah.
Sicily, yeah.
It crossed the strait and then got into Europe, and then from there it went all over Europe.
Absolutely. That's what these things do. Except, of course, that to be clear, like bubonic plague is transmittable human to human. In its final phases, it becomes pneumonic, so it's airborne. There's not a phase at which yellow fever is person to person transmittable. It depends upon that vector of the mosquito. So you have to, what you're really doing is you're introducing the virus into the mosquito population. And then the mosquito is the what carries it from person to person.
Don't afford to imagine, okay, if mosquito is the carrier, how he got from New Orleans to Shreveport
Well, think about it.
at the other end of the state, other side, in a relatively
Think
short
about it.
time.
It's not the mosquito who's flying to Shreveport. All the mosquito had to do was to bite Jose Arrua, who was infected with yellow fever, and then go bite someone else. And now you've got it introduced into the human population. And then we've got another mosquito. We've got a mosquito that's biting multiple people. Now all these people have it in their bodies. So the mosquito then can bite them and transport it to another human being. That's how this works. And then all you need is one person to get on a ship to come to Shreveport who's carrying yellow fever. And now you can introduce it to a whole new mosquito population. I mean, it's mind-boggling for us to consider, but that's exactly how it happened. And this is why mosquito is the number one cause of death in the world. They carry all these diseases.
Now, in 1873, I'm trying to think of transportation between New Orleans and Shreveport. There wasn't any highway.
Steamboat.
Okay,
Steamboat.
it was steamboat going up the river, but
Steamboat.
the river takes you to the opposite end of the state. So
Nope.
people.
No, people, the goods would leave New Orleans and they would put them on the Atchafalaya. And the Atchafalaya cuts into the Red. And then the Red would come north to Shreveport. That's the entire reason Shreveport exists was because that river, Red River, was cleared in 1830s by Captain Henry Miller Shreve to make possible goods from New Orleans to make their way into the Independent Republic of Texas. So no, when you're thinking about the river, yes, New Orleans is the port on the Mississippi, but then those goods would be taken to the Atchafalaya and then from there up the Red north to Shreveport. That was the whole point of Shreveport's existence.
Yeah, I wonder where it joined the Atchafalaya.
I'm not certain. I'd have to, I mean, you can, there's lots of maps. You can
Yeah.
see lot, there's lots of maps. Yeah, but they cut a channel through there to make
Yeah.
the Red River navigable coming northward.
Yeah, okay. All right. But at the time, they didn't know, well, they knew it was yellow fever, but they still didn't know the cause.
Right. They didn't know the cause.
Which has got to make it more difficult when you don't know what the cause is. And it wasn't until what? Was it a decade later that they discovered the cause?
Oh, several decades later, it's the turn of the 20th century when we were digging the Panama Canal. And Dr. Walter Reed is the one who made the connection between mosquito-borne illnesses and these, I mean, mosquito-borne viruses and these epidemics. He's the one that made the connection.
So how were people dealing with this disease that they didn't know the cause of? I mean, how do you treat that? What would you do?
Well, people seem to have intuitively known that they shouldn't be gathering in public. People believe that it was person to person transmittable, though. So they shut down businesses and shops, and all social activities ceased. Things were that would normally be held indoors, like masses, like church services, were held outdoors. We have a sense of that. And then they knew that somehow, believing it was person to person transmittable, they closed the port. So the federal government came in and closed down the port. This happened in New Orleans several times too. In 1853, especially in New Orleans, they did this to shut down the port to traffic. And of course, steamboat traffic is going to figure out a way to get around that. They just stopped south of the quarantine area and offloaded their goods and paid somebody to bring them up by wagon. But people reacted very much as if we would in a flu outbreak or something. We know that's person to person transmittable. People believe the same thing about yellow fever, so they simply avoided each other.
Yeah. So they didn't know the cause, but I guess they knew the pattern that it goes from person to
Yeah,
person, but they didn't know.
they knew They knew that when it was in a population, that there was a very good chance you'd get it.
Okay. So finally, when they discovered it as part of building the Panama Canal, and they realized, okay, it was a mosquito, what is it that the mosquito was carrying that would transmit this disease?
I'm sorry, I guess I don't understand the question. Can you say that again? I missed something.
Yeah. What was the mosquito carrying? Was it some kind of an infection or something? I mean, do they know what it was?
Virus. The virus.
Okay.
The virus that causes yellow fever. Yeah, it's okay. Yellow fever is a virus.
All right.
Yeah.
And do we know where the virus originated? Was it
in South Yes, Africa? It originated in Africa, and it seems to have originated among primates, probably gorillas or chimpanzees.
Uh-huh.
And then it found its way into the human population at some point, probably. The earliest records we have really of something sounding like yellow fever come from the slave trade. We know that there's something that sounds like yellow fever that's on board vessels coming from Africa through the Caribbean in the 1600s.
Yeah. So there's a story that the... Well, first, at that time in 1873, Shreveport was a young town, and it was a thriving town, very prosperous. This, in effect, really shuts it down. I mean, if you have many more deaths. So what happened during that period of time once it's realized that there's an epidemic here?
Well, the city was very slow to call it yellow fever because they knew what it would mean. If they said there was an epidemic, then it meant that the port would close and there would be a quarantine imposed and goods would be embargoed. So the city was very slow to call it yellow fever. But by early September, they really can't deny it because people are dropping dead by the dozens every day. And there's no hiding it anymore. So the city took the appropriate measures as far as quarantining people. They opened up a mass trench in our city cemetery to make for the most efficient disposal of the dead. So we have over 800 bodies that are buried in a single mass grave in our city's oldest cemetery. And then by mid-November, we have a frost, a heavy frost that people didn't know it was the mosquito, but they intuitively knew from history that once the frost came, the illness would go away. They didn't know it's because the mosquito goes dormant when the weather gets cold. But we had that happen 12 weeks later. And so Shreveport simply resumed normal activity by mid-November.
It reminds me when COVID broke out and President Trump saying something like, well, this is going to go away when it gets cold. I think that's what everybody was kind of thinking about, those kinds of things.
Yeah, right. And when I think that it's just kind of our natural, we just sort of intuit that when the weather changes, there's going to be something new break out and there'll be something that goes away. And so, yeah. I mean, how often do we say that about flu season, for instance? You know, well, flu's run its course. We won't see it again for another year. Well, that's because people, the conditions, the changing temperatures in the fall and the winter months make us more susceptible to infection. The drying out of our mucous membranes and nasal passages make us more susceptible. So that's something that people of 1873 would not have known about a common cold, for instance. But we know that.
Now, we mentioned the newspaper, which... like you say, in the early days, it was just reporting all the activity and, I guess, good news out of Shreveport. Once the thing really hit, that the newspapers, would be the Shreveport Times, really spent its time reporting on what was going on. I mean, all the deaths and the diseases and the...
Well, for one point in time, the Shreveport Times became simply a death record. There was no business, industry, or enterprise in Shreveport that wasn't affected by this. So the newspaper lost a lot of its staff. There was nobody to press the pages. And the telegraph office, we had a very poignant story about a telegraph operator who wouldn't leave his post because he was the only one left and it was the only way to get information in and out of Shreveport. And he died at his post. So the same is true of the Times. The Times simply became a death record. They just started publishing a list of the dead every day and reporting on river conditions and weather conditions as if they thought that might have something to do with it, but nobody really knew.
So once it was identified as being carried by mosquitoes, did that change the strategy?
Sure. No? Well, I mean, obviously our public health begins to change in the early 20th century anyway, as we began to understand how diseases are transmitted. We understood more about germ theory, and we understood more about viruses. Once we've identified the mosquito as the carrier, well, then you begin to see major metropolitan areas, urban areas, taking on mosquito abatement as sort of their public health policy. It's the reason, I grew up in a certain era when we used to chase the mosquito spraying truck down the street. We thought that was so cool that they were abating mosquitoes. But we certainly became more aware of that as a major health concern. And now, of course, we know that mosquitoes carry all sorts of things. Mosquitoes carry malaria. Mosquitoes carry the Zika virus, the West Nile virus. It's the same mosquito, by the way, Aedes aegypti mosquito that carries all three, Zika, West Nile, and yellow fever. It's the same type of mosquito. And guess where it is most proliferant? It's right here in the South, the deep South. It's the mosquito that we have.
But do any of those diseases, are they still around these days?
Well, West Nile and Zika for sure. Yeah. Yellow fever, there's still cases every year, but they are mostly reported in Asia and Africa. So for instance, if you travel to the Caribbean today, you're not required to have a yellow fever vaccine. But if you travel to West Africa, you are.
And why did they call it yellow fever?
Because it attacks the liver. And so because it's a direct attack on the liver, the skin turns jaundiced. You turn yellow.
Okay. We're talking to Dr. Cheryl White, who's a history professor at LSU Shreveport. And we're talking about 150 years ago was the yellow fever epidemic in Shreveport. And this year, there's an effort to commemorate it, which we'll talk about. And she's very much involved in that. The mass grave, it was at a place, I don't know if it's called, it's Oakland Cemetery?
Yes, Oakland Cemetery, yes.
And so it was just like 800 people, around 800 people that were buried in there, but a lot of them, there wasn't any identification.
No, and that's really what makes, I think, what we're doing this fall very special is that although the people were put in there without any record of their names on the ground itself, there was no permanent memorial to them with their names. Then what we've done at LSU Shreveport under the sort of the direction of Dr. Gary Joyner, who's the chair of the history department here, students have been able to assist in building a database of names. So we, because of the Shreveport Times being the death record, we have the names of the people who died, or we have a lot of the names. We're missing some. And the ones we're missing are mostly African Americans, by the way, which is a whole other social commentary about the era. But we were able to take that list and sort of cross-reference it against burials we knew were elsewhere. Like if I knew that there was Mr. Smith was buried in another cemetery with his family, I could take him off the list. And we came up with over 800, right at 800 names that we could not account for anywhere. And we assumed, or had to assume, they were in that mound, the mass grave. So one of the things that we've done as part of the commemoration is to commission the construction of a memorial that covers the entire top of that mass grave with pedestals that list all the names that we have. There's an obelisk at the center with an eternal flame that will be dedicated to them on October 7th. And it's a very long overdue project to be able to remember the dead. You know, it's a great privilege to be able to honor the dead. And I guess you would expect a historian to say something like that. But I think it's very important that we do that 150 years later, that we acknowledge that these people lived and they died and they were buried with absolutely no ceremony, no words, no nothing. And we're really, I think, poised to correct that in a big way.
Was there evidence? I'm sure there was, of like whole families that died from this.
Yes. Yes. A couple of families that stand out as having lost several members. There's a very beautiful handwritten note that we have in our LSUS Spring Street Museum, for instance, that a woman named Susan Abriola lost three children and over a matter of just a couple of weeks. And she took the time to write down in her own words that, you know, their names and their ages and the dates. And then at the very bottom, she says they're buried in the mass grave. And, you know, I think it's just a reminder to us. I think maybe especially during COVID, we felt this more acutely, but that we're always sort of, you know, just living on the edge of something that could potentially become a public health disaster. And you get the sense of how unstable things were for families, for businesses. Some families are affected more than others. It's odd in the way that it seems to discriminate at times, you know? So yeah, there we do have some families that are more affected than others.
Now, how far are the Shreveport to spread?
Not far. Shreveport at the time was really pretty much a 64 square block business district that was right on the river. So we have eight streets that run east west and eight streets that run north south that were really that made up Shreveport's business district right on the river. And it didn't really spread beyond that. You know, across the Red River is Bossier Parish. Today, it's Bossier Parish. It wasn't known as Bossier Parish then. It was part of Webster Parish. But we have a few cases that are reported on that side of the river, but not very many. I mean, most of it stayed concentrated in this business district right on the river.
And so how many people in Shreveport died?
But over a little over 1,240-ish. We say 1,246, but that we can't be certain of that number. And again, approximately 800 of those are in a single grave together. So we know that, incidentally, because before we began construction on the monument, we had to do ran a ground penetrating radar on the top of that mass grave to make sure. Well, first of all, to make sure that we would not encounter any human remains in the construction of the memorial, because we knew that some of them were probably pretty shallow. And what we found is that the grave is about 100 feet deep, and the bodies are literally layered up to about 3.5 feet below the surface. It's very, very poignant.
Were they putting coffins or
no.
Wrap in some sort of...
No, no. They were simply buried what they were wearing.
Okay. So the lifespan of this incident from when those three guys were first discovered into what, to November? So what's about 6 months or so?
No. It's 12 weeks.
Okay.
12 weeks. Yeah.
Sure.
Late August 21st until about mid-November. So it's about 12 months.
So 700, what was the number you gave? How many people died within those?
Over 1,200 people that we're certain of. It could be more than that, but that's what we, about 1,240-ish that we know. There could be more, but that's the number that we have. And about 800 of them are buried in this mass grave.
Well, imagine what life was like during that period. Well, the question was, would life exist? But I mean, every day you're living with this and all these people
right.
are dying, and I'm sure.
Right.
People know people. Was there any sort of evacuation? Did people flee town, or did it?
A lot of people left. People of means could go. They could get on the train and go until the trains stop running. But we know that a lot of people fled. And we think as much as a third of the city's population may have fled before the federal government enforced the quarantine. So they went to East Texas primarily. And of course, a lot of people who left Shreveport thinking they were leaving, fleeing the virus, fleeing the disease, they didn't know what it was, they carried it with them. So they infected people other places. There's an outbreak in Jefferson, Texas. There's an outbreak in Marshall, Texas. There's a really great story of an armed mob that stopped the train just outside the Dallas city limits and said, "You will not pass," because they knew that the train was coming from Shreveport.
So when it came to an end, it wasn't because of anything that technology or was doing.
It's just something as simple as a frost.
Yeah.
And what happens over generations is that we have developed a natural immunity to it. It doesn't affect our populations like it did in the 19th century, 18th and 19th century. So as we began to live more communally and in denser populations, we just sort of developed. It's one of the beautiful things about the human body, right? Is it just seems to adapt, and we adapted a natural immunity to it.
Oh, there's a side story to this that we've talked to you about before, but I think it's an amazing story about a group of priests.
Yes.
Who came. So tell us about that.
Well, we had Shreveport had really only one Catholic priest living in Shreveport at the time of the outbreak of the epidemic. But he had an associate pastor who was not in the city. He was actually on the Bossier side of the river, recuperating from tuberculosis. Then there was a third priest that was assigned to a convent just south of Shreveport. And when the fever broke out, the first priest, who was the pastor at Holy Trinity, Father Jean-Pierre, he called his associate in and said, I need your help. You know, we've got to nurse these sick people." And so that was Father Camaret, who was just 26 years old. And Father Camaret was the first to die. He died on September the 15th. The next day, the pastor there, Father Pierre, died September 16th, but not before he had summoned in Father Billet, who was from the convent. So Father Billet comes into downtown, into the fever ward, and he realized that he was going to be next. He knew that he had put himself in a situation where he was also going to die. So he sent word to two other priests, one of them in Monroe and one of them in Natchitoches, to come to his aid. And he basically said, "I'm the only priest here." And the priest in Monroe, Father Gergaud, got on the stagecoach that night, and he said this in front of witnesses, "Write to the bishop and tell him I go to my death. It is my duty and I go." The priest in Natchitoches came by horseback, took him 4 days, and he was heard to say to people when he was leaving Natchitoches, when someone said, "You're going to your death," he said, "I believe it. I'm taking the surest and shortest path to heaven." So Father Gergaud and Father Lebezouet, the final two, arrived in Shreveport within just a day or two of each other. Father Billet, priest number three, died on September 26th. Father Gergaud died on October 1st. We're marking his anniversary this coming Sunday in Monroe. And then Father Lebezouet died on October 8th. So within 3 weeks, within 21 days, five Roman Catholic priests laid down their lives for complete strangers, going into a situation where many people were fleeing from. These guys were coming in. I mean, can you imagine what the ferryman on the river must have thought? Another priest? Are you kidding me? You know, and all five of them. So they are now in the Vatican's canonization process for sainthood.
Now, Shreveport at the time was under the Archdiocese of Natchitoches, is that correct?
No, Diocese of Natchitoches, Archdiocese of New Orleans.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So did any of the church hierarchies say something about this, like "don't go"? Or
yeah, we have a letter that Bishop Auguste Martin, who was the Bishop of Natchitoches, a letter that he wrote to Father Louis Gergaud on September 30th. But see, now Gergaud died on October 1st, so it's too late. But he wrote a letter, basically not knowing he'd already left Monroe. He wrote a letter to him and said, don't go. You know, by God, this is enough. Don't go. I've already lost three priests. And, but then when Father Lebezuet was summoned to Shreveport, he basically told him, if you know, you have to do what your conscience tells you. And if you want to go, son, I go. So Father Lebezuet got on horseback and came. But it's a remarkable story for a couple of reasons. One of them is the timeline that Shreveport was never, we didn't have a large Catholic population the way that New Orleans does, but Shreveport was never left without the sacraments. These priests were never left without the comforts of the church, because one priest arrived in time to give the last sacraments to the one before him. So they sort of passed the baton that way. But remarkable mostly because it's a choice. It was a free and willing choice that they made to do this, knowing that they would die.
Now, these weren't priests that were medically inclined. They were just offering what, spiritual guidance?
They were just holding people's hands, praying with them, putting a cold compress on someone's head, maybe picking up medicines from the druggist or the infirmary, but no, they were not medical doctors.
And where were these priests buried?
Today, four of them rest together in Shreveport at St. Joseph's, the Catholic cemetery. Three of them were there, and we just moved on the 150th anniversary of the death of Father Belay on September 26th. His remains were moved from another cemetery in Shreveport to rest beside these other three. So four of them are together today. The priest from Monroe, Father Gergaud, was originally buried in our city cemetery. And then in February of 1874, the Catholics of Monroe came and basically exhumed him and took him back to Monroe, where he's buried in their churchyard.
Okay. Well, it's always good to have a saint.
I think it might start a war between Monroe and Shreveport now, if I suggested that we take him back.
Yeah. So, and you've probably seen things like that in your study of medieval history. That kind of thing. So you're involved in the canonization process.
Yes.
Which is a very.
I'm actually the chair of the historical commission for the cause.
And it's a very complex, slow-moving process.
It is.
But how's it going?
Good. We're actually, the work of the Historical Commission is almost complete. I would say we would complete our work within the next 6 months. And that means that the diocesan phase will be concluded. It will go back to Rome. It'll go back to, actually, specifically to Pope Francis for his consideration. He is the one who will decide if they are made venerable. So right now they are servants of God. That's the first step. That is an act of a diocesan bishop with the Vatican's approval. So the Vatican has to say it's okay, and then he declares them servants of God. So now the process goes back to Rome, and it is the Pope who decides if they are venerable. That's the second phase. And then we wait for miracles, because the third step is to be a blessed, beatified, and the fourth step is saint, canonized. So we're on the way. But, you know, to be canonized a saint can take centuries. That's not unusual. But I think that we will see them made venerable. I would be very surprised if we didn't see that in our lifetimes, in the next few years, maybe.
So they'd be referred to as blessed so-and-so. Blessed.
No, they would be referred to as venerable, like the Venerable Fulton Sheen, for instance. I mean, they would have the title of venerable, but then when they are beatified, that's the blessing.
Yeah. All right. And I guess you're familiar with the New Orleans, the story with Father Silos.
Blessed Silos, yes. Yes, I'm not, don't know the ins and outs of his story, but I'm familiar with the canonization clause.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were these priests of a particular religious order?
No, they were diocesan priests. They all came from the same area of Brittany, France at different times. Three of them came together in 1854, and then the other two came a little bit later in the 1860s and early 1870s. But they all came from an area of France that's, you know, just within the same region.
Someone was infected with this. Was it a lingering disease, or could they just go right away?
The course is different for everyone, but it's several days. Most of them lived at least a few days knowing that they were ill. In the case of Father Belay, he had been ill for a few days and seemed to be recovering. He seemed to be one of those that was going to get over the illness, and then he had a relapse. So, but yeah, it's a several day process, and it's progressive. I mean, once you're in complete liver failure, and you know, the jaundice really sets in, and it's a pretty dramatic looking illness, for sure.
Well, you mentioned the one priest who died one day, and then the other one died the next day.
Yeah, they died within 24 hours of each other.
So they must have both known, like.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and it's interesting that when Father Belay, the third priest, came to give the final rites to Father Pierre, who was the second priest to die, Father Pierre had a moment where he appeared to have been a little, he was coherent, and he asked where Father Cameray was, who was his associate, who had died the day before, and seemed confused that he was not there to give him his last rites. And it was, in fact, a priest that he had summoned into Shreveport because he knew he was going to die. So the whole story is very poignant. I would say we rarely see this kind of an assemblage of virtue in concentrated in a small group of people in a very specific situation. It makes it very unique.
And especially Catholic priests in a town that wasn't really very much.
It was overwhelmingly Protestant and Jewish. Yeah.
Is there, do people on the street in Shreveport, are they aware of it? I mean, is this a big thing in Shreveport?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, I think most people, we've done a pretty good job of making the events known. And,
okay. Yeah. So with the commemoration efforts, there was a ceremony to announce the commemoration and the
right.
And you mentioned y'all going to do something with the burial site. There could be a few events throughout the year. Commemoration is a lot different from a celebration. Okay.
We're not using the word celebration because it's not. But it is a commemoration. And I think it's important we mark these significant moments in history.
Yeah. Well, congratulations for your efforts.
Thank you.
On all that. Let me ask you about just quickly one of your other research projects, if you don't mind.
Okay. I have a few minutes.
Okay. Well, I'll touch on this quickly because I've got to tell you, my hidden motive is that one day I'd like to come back and talk to you about this topic.
Okay.
And that's the Shroud of Turin.
Yes.
That you've been working on, that, which is one of the great mysteries of the church.
It's incredible. Incredible. I've studied it for 30 years.
Yeah. Where is it now? I mean, where's the project? Do you think that there's movement, or is it
I don't think that we're likely to see any more scientific examination of the cloth anytime soon. No. There's too much concern about its conservation and preservation right now. Certainly there would be nothing done to it that would be intrusive or destructive. So basically everything that we know is based on that original 1978, the only time it's ever been allowed to be scientifically examined. But we have samples. We have textual samples and blood samples, and we're able to continue to test. So we know a good bit we're able to learn more and more and more as our technologies and as science advances. So the fascinating thing about that cloth is that the more our technologies and science advance and we answer questions, the more questions we have. We still can't answer the question of how the image got there. Well, I say we can't answer it. We can do it in theoretical physics. We can hypothetically calculate how the image got there, but we just can't reproduce it.
Yeah. If they have blood samples?
We do have blood samples.
Like blood samples from the cloth? I mean,
yes.
Blood
yes.
sample of Christ?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are, well, I mean, depending on who you think the man of the shroud
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's a blood sample of the man of the shroud.
There were blood samples that were taken, that were permitted to be taken, that are under very strict controls. They are used for research purposes and were used for research purposes. It's the reason we know that the man is a man and we know that he has type AB blood. How else would we know that if we hadn't taken blood samples? So, yeah. It's a fascinating topic, though. We should put a pin in that and come back to it.
Okay. We promise if I ask you.
I promise. I promise.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, this has been fascinating, like all of you.
Good. Like thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.